This is Joe Leith speaking at the 1983 East Texas Roundup in Longview, Texas.
Tonight I'm acting as chairman of this meeting, and as is customary for each of us, I will first introduce myself. My name is Gene. I am an alcoholic, and by God's grace, working in and through people like you, I'm sober today and have been since June 16, 1951. Some 31 years, 9 months, something in that area, but I'm one drink away from a drunk and one thought away from a drink. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Let us have a few moments of silent prayer and meditation, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I am supposed to say a few remarks, but they said you've already talked twice, so don't talk anymore. But I can't help but, in introducing this man, say a few things about him because I have known him so many years. He and I have been friends some 30-odd years. I don't know how many. But in the early days, when I needed help the most, there was people like he that helped me. He and his wife and my wife and myself and other couples would get together, and we found out what the fellowship of AA really was. And it's amazing to me tonight to look out here and see you, a few hundred people, and to recall some of my early days in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can recall over in Kilgore, Texas one time, I had been on one of my sober stretches for about 3 months, which was pretty good for me at that time. And they made me chairman of the meeting the following night. There were about 12 to 14 in our group, and it worried me to death because I had to get up behind this podium and be a chairman. I knew there was no way out, and that was going to be 1 week from the Monday night that they told me about this ordeal. And there was only one way I could get out of it, so I drank. And then they couldn't. That's the beautiful thing I like about this program. If you have a desire to stop drinking, you're in. And if you drink, you're out. It's just that simple. I can recall, I believe it was in 1954, after I had been sober some 3 years, that I went to the state convention at Fort Worth, where Bill W. had come down to help out his sponsor, Eddie. And it was one of the most wonderful meetings I had ever attended in my whole life at that time. And Joe was there. Not only was he there, he was on the program. And I envied him. 1955, the following year at the state convention, I mean at the international convention in St. Louis, Joe was there. Everywhere I went, he was there. He was the type that would go and keep going. I recall in 1960, the International Convention in Long Beach, California. Not only was he there, but he was on the program. But it was at 2 o'clock in the morning. As much as I loved him, I couldn't stay up that long. I was dancing to the band of Les Brown and the Band of Renown. And that brings up another statement. We're going to have a dance as soon as this is over, and I don't know what I like the best, a dance or the talk. But I think I'm going to turn this thing over shortly. So I'm going to ask you, whenever this meeting is over tonight and it's dismissed, to clear this place out as fastly as possible without breaking any legs. or causing any more disruption so we can get the dance on the road. Without any other word, I want at this time to introduce, and that's a pleasure, I mean a deep pleasure, to introduce our speaker for tonight, Joe L. from Tyler, Texas. Joe.
Thank you, Dean. God almighty. In the few minutes I have left, this is the only disease known to mankind where the newcomer apologizes for not having it longer. I think this is a rather festive occasion for me. It really is. And we've had, what is it here? We've had four old men. I'm sick of these old men, for God's sake. You know, there's four of them. Look at them down the line. There's a, you can tell me from the rest of them, I've got hair. And that differentiates us. I don't know. I've been a long way in AA. Been here a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time, for God's sake. And I think that this is a real festive occasion. One reason, I've been out of pocket for a year. I had a little accident. I lost my mind. And it's been coming back to me slowly but surely for last year. So any degree of improvement that I've made, you will promise not forgive me for it. I don't know about AA. I think cliches are devised to make disaster more palatable for us. You know, we want to find an excuse for everything that happens to us. And I don't know, AA is becoming very fashionable now. You know, we used to be worried about the stigma on alcoholism. And we're not worried about it, it seems, anymore. I have a nephew who's a psychiatrist. You know, psychiatrist, the art of picking the pocket through the scalp, if you didn't know. Yeah. But I have a nephew who's a psychiatrist in Dallas, of course. And then I have another nephew in San Francisco who's a homosexual. And you know, my people bag on them more than they do on me, and I'm an alcoholic. And, so there's no way to win on that thing. I don't know, but it is becoming real fashionable now. We understand that they're introducing alcoholics into the plots of the soap operas in the West Coast. You've heard that, haven't you? They're replacing us with other people, and alcoholics, of course. We've just replaced two bad ovaries and one homosexual down there in the last time. So it has become very fashionable, and I think that the stigma on alcoholism is a thing of the past, really. Looking at this crowd, you look different from what we looked like when we came to AA, don't you, Paul? We were under the bridge, people. So I'm grateful for that fact. I don't know. I wondered when I came to AA how this thing got started. And I thought it surely must have started by some brilliant visionary or some do-gooder, you know. And when I found out that AA was started by two guys that couldn't drink any better than I could, I liked it right off. And that's been the way I felt about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got a kick out of the kids that's come out of the 60s and the 70s. They're not like we old last Gaspers were. And they have a hang-up, you know, and they want to identify, they say. You know, got to identify. Well, I've got some news for you. You can identify, and if you just still don't find the solution to your problem, you're still in trouble. Identification is all right. We had 40, what was that old pamphlet we used to have? 44 questions. You know, they had it with a little innocuous questions. Did your wife give you that look last night? Or some little innocuous thing. And they didn't have much to do with my type of alcoholism. So I have devised, out of my sheer brilliance, some questions that I can ask you and help you identify. And I think it'll take less than 44 to do the trick. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving? Have you ever had your wife throw an electric light cord in the bathtub with you? Have you ever woke up with a circus midget in bed? Well, I'm talking about that. Did you hear about the circus midget that got thrown out of the nudist colony because he was going around getting his nose in everybody's business? I think we want to unify, don't you, Paul, huh? Have you ever done the Tennessee waltz in a straitjacket? Have you ever had... Oh, this is nasty. Have you ever had malfunction of the zipper? They used to call me Rusty. I think we're getting along good. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? I guess all the alcoholics complain of how hard a time they've had. Have you ever been run over by the welcome wagon? I think we've gone far enough with that. I'll give you the last question. Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your glasses and wash your teeth with preparation H? That will give you a pucker. Yes, sir. I don't know. I think we can identify here. I don't think we've had any problem along those lines. So, damn, what else can you do to chicken besides that? And we can be identified and not have to worry about it. And I'm grateful for that fact. And no, I'm going to tell you a little nauseous story. It has but one purpose, and I think if I had any text to my sermon at all, I'm going to talk about the 12th step revisited. Everybody else has had a whack at the steps, and Paul's going to talk about the steps tomorrow, and talked about the big book. That's that big book that, it's a blue book, in case you don't know what it is. The big blue book, in case you didn't know what it is. And it's about this long and about this high. And in case you never have seen one of them, you're in for a new experience. Because it's a text, says it is our basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm going to talk about a little bit. These guys get up here and say they're not going to talk about drinking. And then immediately they start talking about it. So I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to talk a little bit about drinking, because that's what caused my problem. I didn't have a thinking problem. I had a drinking problem. And I had to find some solutions to it. So I was just a good kid, I guess, you know. And ordinary kid raised over here in Tyler, Texas. That's about 40 miles over there. Nobody here from Tyler, is it? Nobody ever goes to Tyler intentionally. It's made up of people who got lodged in, or, you know, got by mistake. But anyway, I went to found my first drink at age 17. And purely and simply because I wanted to be accepted in a group of boys. And I remember that drink, and I remember E. Marsh talking about, and I want to talk to you about what alcohol does for us instead of to us, because that's the difference between me and people who drink, is what alcohol does for me. And that's the thing, the root of all my trouble. And that night, I went and drank on 17 years old, and I remember that drink vividly. There's never been another experience like that. And I did two things that night. I eventually threw up and passed out. And I did that for the next 19 and a half years. And I didn't have I've heard people say, you know, they had no reason to drink. I didn't have any. You don't have to have a reason to drink. You don't have to say, I drank because. Until one day when it's too late, and then you say you drink because you're an alcoholic. But there's no reason for me drinking. I had all the chances that any ever kid ever had, and drank. And I started to move, you know. When an alcoholic, in the big book, I'm going to quote it a couple of times if you don't mind. Bill said that the alcoholic has a very short memory. He cannot remember the pain of even a week ago. Even a week ago. And I went through this routine time and time again. And Tyler became too small for me. I was quickly, pardon me. Always maintain the dignity of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Tyler became too small for me, and it wasn't long until I started moving. And I moved as a result of being an alcoholic for the next 19 and a half years, never being satisfied with anywhere. And I ended up, of all places, in Hollywood, California. That's where the freaks are. And I picked for my profession, as a country kid, believe it or not, I became an understudy to one of the more eminent designers of ladies' lingerie. Now, this is a country kid, and this guy took me in, fine Jewish fellow, and showed me everything that he knew. He predicted that I would go far in the business, and sure enough, I did. And this is where you cut these soft silk sleazy things that the women wear, you know. If any of you got a pinch now, haven't been there a long time. And this is where I came face to face with Alcoholics Anonymous, really, with alcohol, not Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing about that. when you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of those places in them, you're nuts. And I told the psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. Needless to say, I cut myself out of the garment business, and it didn't take long doing it. This fine Jewish fella used to drink with me, and he could not understand why I couldn't drink with him. He could not understand. And one day he said the thing to me that alcoholics can't stand. He said, "Joe, you can't drink." Man, that sets us afire, don't it? We don't like "you can't," and we don't like "don't." We've something in our nature that prohibits us from standing for like that. And he said, "You can't drink." Just recently I was talking in the University of Illinois, and I was talking, you know, making a beautiful dissertation there, and I looked over on the wall, and I could see this sign, and it said, "Don't." And I couldn't keep my eyes off of it. And I'd talk a little while, and I'd look over there on the wall, and it said, "Don't." And I looked a little closer, and it said, "Don't take the dishes out of this hole." I can't stand that. I've got two of them damn dishes in my room now. And they have absolutely no collectible value. But they said, "Don't take the dishes." That's our nature. We cannot stand "don't," and "you can't." And he said, "You can't drink." Just like that. And you can well imagine how it hurt my feelings. And, oh, God, I couldn't stand it. But he was a very humorous guy, this whimsical, is that a good word? And he said, "There's always some good comes out of everything." And I wondered what the hell he could be talking about. He said, "The way you handle those scissors, if you'd have been a rabbi, you'd have destroyed our whole race." We gotta let that roll around. Needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession. And this was the first hurt. This was the first indignity. This was the first thing that I had to make an excuse for. We don't like making excuses, and I didn't like it. This first indignity. I'd like to say to you now, as an aside, that I have just retired from my fifth profession, all as a result of being an alcoholic. Well, I'll make it quick. I went down to San Pedro, and the war was going on at that time, and I bought with good money a plumber's license out the back door of Union Hall. And I went into the shipyard as a master plumber, and you well know that I was a master fraud. And they said, "Here it comes again. You can't." What they said in essence was, if you remember those horrible days, you're frozen to your job. And there was something about that I didn't quite like, you know. Here it comes. You can't. Well, I got a report to you that I've got a little piece of paper that hangs in my den now that prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Who said you can't quit? Here we go. Gotta go all the time. And you hear the old plaintive cry, the Al-Anon, "Honey, let's go somewhere where people don't know us." Have you ever heard that? Maybe we were saying something else. But let's go somewhere where people don't know us. Let's start over again. Let's go to new scenery. And the alcoholic starts traveling. And I ended up in Northern California, made the fast trip from there and of all the places to go to work. You see, I've noticed something about alcoholics, we alcoholics, that the arrow always points down. Our chances to do things are always less and less. And we sit on that bar stool, and who was it, the little lady? Tomorrow it's going to be different. Tomorrow it's going to be better. And we do the same thing. That proves that alcoholics are real stupid, because we do the same thing every day and expect a different answer. You ever thought of that? We keep doing the same thing and expecting a different answer. Tomorrow it's going to be different. And I went to work for the railroad, and I've got to say here that the most narrow-minded group of people I've ever come in contact with, they've got a rule about drinking. They say that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, that you can be fired. Well, I didn't come out very often. And if I did, I was an unidentified flying object. But I guess that they figured that if a guy was a little bit addled, he might mix them up, you know. And that's easy to happen, and that's exactly what I did. And I'll tell you a story there that has quite a moral to it. I never could get my wife to quit having whiskey bottles from me, you know. That's a plaintive cry. But I got called one night to this particular train crew, and I enlisted in my group five fellows just like me. We had to help the engineer up on the engine to get him out of the place. It's a damn good thing you don't have to drive a train, you know that. We had to get the fireman out of jail, but anyway, we got started towards a little town called Marysville. If you've never been to Marysville, you don't know what mosquitoes are like. But we went out, and we got in pretty good shape in that 35 miles. We really got in good shape. We fell over a few switches and, made a general ass of ourselves. And to my delight, I found a track that had a shed, an opening in it. You know, it was an almond shed of some kind. And the thought occurred to me that if we'd split up all the cars and cut them up, you know, and make them look like they weren't a train, just a car here and a car there. And then we put the engine and the caboose in this shed and locked the door. And when we went to the bar, and the dispatcher was concerned about us. He hadn't heard from us in a long time. And the war was going on at that time, and trains were going every which way. And poor guy was really concerned. And finally, at 2 o'clock in the morning, he came into this bar in Marysville, California, and found us. And this is what he said. "What did you do with it?" And I always couldn't hide a jug from that boat I was married to. But I've never had an experience like that in all my life. This was, this railroad was something else. They kept me going for a long time, and I finally started work on passenger trains, and I can't imagine. I always wondered how they run more than one train on the track. But never did find out, really. But I just used to sit there and hold my watch in my hand and go in horror of the time that we were going to just mess it up. And they had an interlocking system in this railroad. You know what an interlocking system is. Up at the top of the mountain, we went from sea level to 7,000 feet in 90 miles on this piece of railroad. And he started, and we came along, and he told me about the pardon me again. And we looked at this interlocking system, and they made another boast, and they said, "You can't." They made a boast about this interlocking system and hung a bulletin and said, "It is physically impossible to make a mistake up there." What were they saying to me? You know, "You can't." Here we go again. So I did it without any trouble at all. We got two cars going towards one another with five cars between them, apples, carrots, lettuce, and celery, and make it the biggest fruit salad on earth. And you know, those narrow-minded people wanted to fire me for that, and they had a big investigation over it, and finally gave me 60 days, and I remember the old superintendent was livid with rage. He said, "You ought to be fired for even walking on our right of way." And then he said a thing that some of our Al-Anons have said at one time or another. He said, "I'll get you if it's the last thing I ever do." And somehow or other, I got the idea that we were living on a hostile planet. Somehow or other, alcoholics alienate themselves. You know, you can't do it. And finally, I had to give it all up. And I ended up in a railroad hospital in the case of DTs. And this is really about the end of the line for me. And there's no talking about having DTs. People have had those, and you don't discuss DTs in good society, except in treatment centers you talk about them, but they do it hush-hush. So I ended up in a railroad hospital, and on the verge of being fired, and that was where I came face to face with psychiatry. And the psychiatrist asked me a lot of silly questions, and I gave him a lot of brilliant answers, questions, personal questions that I hate, you know, and meddling with my personal and private business. He asked me one time, "Did you wet the bed?" And that's always bothered me. I know that's a cause of it, instead, you know, it's not a cause of it, it's a result of it. And then one day he asked me, "Did you ever suck your thumb?" And I remember when I graphically told him how I did it, and I said to him, "I still do." I remember how pale he came. And so I didn't get along with that. And finally they decided that I should go somewhere. This is it. I've come to the conclusion that the alcoholic lives under one rule: keep him moving. That's the way they treat an alcoholic. And they kept me moving all the time. So this psychiatrist came in one day. He was real upset with me. I'd been going around cheering up some of the patients, and he didn't like him. And he said, "Where are your people?" And I said, "Well, down in Texas." And I think his little eyes lit up. He said, "Well, go down there by all means." And that was my going back to Texas. And I hated it with a passion. I hated Texas with a passion. I didn't want to go near it. But when you get in the shape that we find ourselves in, you do what you can. And that's the best you can do. And I went back to Texas. And now it won't be so funny. It was the reversal absolute reversal of the story of the prodigal son when I came back. They saw him coming from afar and threw his butt in jail. And I never have been quite that badly humiliated in all my life. I was sitting there hating my own mother for bringing this great humiliation down upon me. And I couldn't think of anything else. And one day, a fellow came to my jail cell and called for me by name. And if you don't remember anything else I say here tonight, I want you to remember one word. That fellow came unsolicited. Because if you dingbats have waited for me to roll over and bark to join Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have had to die. I would have had to die. I was that far in the shell. And this guy came to see me unsolicited. And I remember how calm he was, and he told me about the message of Alcoholics Anonymous purely and simply. But I couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. I knew something was about it, and he left his name and address with me. And then he said, as though he had just been waiting on a stoplight, he wasn't concerned a bit about me. He says, if you ever need us, call us. And with that, he left. Now, this guy had read the second part of chapter 7 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it reads, practical experience shows us that the surest immunity against drinking, is intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail. When your prior group blows it, when your transcendental meditation group blows it, when your sitting and touching group blows it, this works when all other activities fail. And he knew it. He had read his lessons well. And then in this small chapter, portion of the chapter, Bill makes us a promise. Or he makes us, occurs in that chapter, one of the only of three exclamation marks in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe. And he says, unequivocally, is that a good word? And carry this message to the other alcoholics. And that's what this guy told me. That's what he told me. And I couldn't take it. But I never could erase him from my memory. My people were good, substantial citizens down there, and they arranged... No, they didn't arrange. They paid two deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car and carry me to Houston and sit with me until the train went west. This is what we euphemistically talk about in Al-Anon as releasing him with love. Yeah. That one's got a lot of good mileage on there. And they carried me off that train in a wheelchair. I went down to visit that the other day with Clancy, and we looked at it and cried a little bit. And for the next 5 months, I can honestly say to you that I literally went through hell. And there's no way you can get out from under that bridge. There is no way for you to get out from under that bridge except by the sign that hangs in our all AA clubs. But for the grace of God. That's the only way you can get out of there. And one night, I'd read that damn pamphlet. I'd seen it. I'd never read it. Slaves of Drink, Find Peace of Mind. That was the pamphlet that the man handed me that eventually saved my life. It was a pamphlet that was written by two losers. A doctor who had died drunk and a pillhead who I saw not so long ago flapping around on his ankles. By two losers. This guy that had written this pamphlet. And it proves one thing to me. That if we can't learn to love the losers, we're not ever going to have any winners at all. This I believe sincerely. But I weathered the storm, and one night I got all of me I could stand. I'd already taken care of you many times over, but that was my night, and I hope that everybody within the sound of my voice can have your night and keep it and protect it, because if you lose your night, you may never get it again. Alcoholism is a fatal an incurable malady. And believe me that it is. And I walked, literally walked out of that flop house for 2,600 miles to find that guy that had given me that pamphlet. That's a story of pathos and tragedy, isn't it? Wouldn't you love to tell a story like that? And amid all the tears, and when I'd been sober 6 months, I found out that there was an AA club 3 blocks from that goddamn flop house. We're smart, you know that? I'm going to a seminar sometime that talks about the teen alcoholic mind. I wonder, have you ever heard of them, Paul? God Almighty, we're smart. Had to walk 2,600 miles, and there was an AA club 3 blocks away. But I'm glad it happened that way. It took everything that it took to get me out from in front of me, because that was the big problem. I couldn't get loose from me, and it took everything that it got. Now I'm going to tell you about the first AA meeting that I ever went to. Because I've had to, compare every AA meeting with that one. There was an old sheriff who had locked me up 12 years prior to that time for felonious drunk driving. And here he sat in the AA clubhouse within 2 years sober. He was a rough old sheriff. He had a reputation for brutality. He was known to bounce prisoners off of the wall of his places. And here he was in AA. As kind and as gentle as a man you could ever see. And he came up to me that night and gave me the essence of this society when he put his arm around me and said, "I love you, boy. And you can stay sober just like I do." What is the transmittal of this great thing that we have? Some philosopher once said that it is greater thing, a greater feat, to jog the understanding than it is to jog the memory. What is this great thing, the transmittal of it? I think we find it at that low, low, low point in desperation, when we see the first glimmer of hope and understanding. And that old sheriff showed it to me that night. I'll never forget that meeting. And out to one side of me, there was a big guy sitting there, and I knew him, but I was still a little bit addled. And he was sitting there smoking a cigar, gently puffing on the cigar, had on a big diamond ring, and he had one of those Trinity things, like what's his name he's got there, you know, in there. Real picture of serenity. And I wondered about him, and I thought, well, when my meeting was over, I'm going to talk to him. And I found out that I had soldiered with him 20 years prior to that time, and the last time I had seen him, he was a blubbering idiot. We had him chained to a post in an army camp. That was their treatment for alcoholism. And he was a comedian. He was a goon. And he had run up and down this post, you know, like an idiot. And here he sat in an AA club. Perfect picture of peace and serenity. You know what my reaction was? I thought if it will help him that much, it'll make a goddamn genius out of me. You know, I couldn't think about that. So, I made it. And I went to see my first AA member. And I'm going to tell you about that. This is a good time to do. I got a call one night, and it proves that you don't know how long you work with an alcoholic. But this guy was real scurvy, kind of like me, and I borrowed a goblet full of whiskey to give him. I really knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshuffled from the drink I had given him, he was in the AA club. I believe any way to get him there is all right, you know. And he stayed sober for 3 months. And then he got drunk. And it didn't hurt him too much, but it was a hell of a blow to my ego. And I just knew that he had to sober up under my guidance. And I went and got him again. And I sober 3 months, drunk again. And I kind of made a side project out of him, you know. I'd pray about him, you know. I'd say, God, you've been watching the spares too much to let me have with him, you know. But he was a hell on wheels. 4.5 years I worked with him. Never got to talk to him too much. He's always drunk. But I knew that he one day, that this guidance of mine would take effect. And I didn't give up. About 12 years ago, he got on what was for him his last drunk. And he called another fellow from our club, who's not near as smart as I am, and he talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he's never had another drunk since. And I'd look at him in the club and think, you ought to be mine. Yeah. And if I know anything in the treasure that God gives us in this society, I owe him more than he owes me. That dummy kept me sober for 4.5 years. That's what he did. I called him another drunk. A guy that was about as scurvy as that. I don't get any of these good-looking women. So where were you when I got ready to come, you know? I get these scurvy old men, you know. Look like, what's his name back there? I'm not going to bet you haven't been before. Yeah, I get nothing but the scurvy old man. But this guy called, and really the only thing he wanted to do was retrieve his jug. That's all he wanted to do. I didn't know that. I was so godlike. You know, I've developed that little characteristic. Have you ever seen any alcoholics or godlike? So, I put him in a car between me and another AA member, and I started driving slowly and giving him the pitch. Oh, God, I felt good. Oh, God, it was a thing to behold, you know. I was rather loquacious, you know. And I talked, and pretty soon his eyes began to water. And I thought, I'm getting him. Oh, it was something to behold. And pretty soon he gently lay his head over on my shoulder, and I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of a drunk throwing up silently? Every time I was getting drunk and godlike, the one of them, they puke on me. I don't know that. I can't do that. I don't know how to end this thing, because my heart is so filled with gratitude for a society that I've given so little to. And these people who are all around me, I love them more than one. And I don't know. Maybe I could tell a little story that I'm quite fond of to get on from here. And that would be a story about a sick guy. The only difference in this story and the stories in the big book is that it didn't come out of the big book. It came out of the scriptures. And I'm very fond of it because it is indicative of my condition. And it's a story that was in the scripture about the demoniac. I don't know whether you've read it. Most of you have read it. It's amazing me. But this guy was sick. He said he was so sick that he was so wild that no man could tame him like me. He said the manifestations of his disease were such that they had to keep him in fetters and chains like me. And finally, the condition, they had to run him out of town just exactly like me. And he ended up on the riverbank eating with the pigs. I can see this picture. I can feel it, and I suspect that those of you who have been there can feel it and see it. The poor guy, the nut, eating with the pigs. I can smell it. And there seems to have been at that time a little carpenter fellow who had an affectation that we hadn't quite acquired yet in Alcoholics Anonymous. He could see no error in anyone. And he said to the nut, the same thing that the guy said to me in jail, are you having any trouble? And the nut says, well, trouble is my name. They call me Legion, which means many. And the little carpenter didn't say to him, are you ready? He effected a treatment that was as little understood in those days as the treatment of Alcoholics Anonymous is today. Had to be pitching out the evil spirits out of these pigs, and they went into the sea and were dead. And that's not the end of the story. They came, and they came up on the pigs, and there were some stew pigeons around, like there always is. And they went to the people that owned the pigs and said to them, you're out of the pig business. And these people were incensed at that, at the loss of their material, loss of their pigs. They weren't interested in the fact that one fellow got well. Believe you me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we'd either be concerned with when one fellow gets well. How many of you dudes came in a bunch? So they went prevailed upon them to leave. They went out en masse, and here comes the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. It said, When they got there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. That's what we got. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But they wanted to get the guy out, and they prevailed upon him. And I can see the fellow in his timidity, and he appealed to his sponsor, and he said, "Let me go with you." and the little carpenter broke a rule for us. Everybody that he had ever helped up until that time, he had always said, go on and tell anybody about it. You were blind and now you see. But he broke a rule for us. And he said to the nut, what I will say to you, stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. At this time, let us all stand and hold hands and repeat the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.